Welcome to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud, available on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, or Apple Podcast, or as always, head on over to the website AmericaOutLoud.com and check out the articles and podcasts, and please share those on social media. We have a big show tonight with Jewish journalist Heather Robinson, and a lot to talk about with what's been going on over in Israel with their conflict with the Palestinians and Hamas. We're looking forward to her thoughts from that. Recently, we've seen such an uptick in anti-Semitic crimes across the country. We've seen them happen in New York, Los Angeles, Texas, all over the place. We are seeing run-ins with Israel and the Palestinians. Even though there's a ceasefire now, it looks like there's going to be some kind of backlash. You notice the media is not really paying as much attention to the Jews getting attacked by the Palestinians as they did the recent Asian hate crimes. What have you thought of that, Rob?
Andrew, I'm really disappointed. I'm disappointed in what we're seeing. This is 2021. A decade ago, Israel was our strongest and staunchest ally, and vice versa. We supported Israel without any reservations. Now, 2021, you look at the makeup of the House. In my opinion, my humble opinion, we have members of a Trojan horse on the House. And they seem to be running interference for terrorist group. Yes, I said it. People might not like it. But we're at the stage of the game whereby you have to call an ace a ace and a spade a spade. What's happening is not good. I don't care what your political persuasion may be. Israel is our ally. Plain and simple. Now, some would say, oh, well, Israel, they're not all innocent and blah, blah, blah. Well, and they're still our allies. And we have to remember that. President Trump, in my humble opinion again, was one of the greatest presidents in favor of Israel. Look at where he moved the embassy. Other presidents said that they would do it. They didn't get it done. This president got it done. What did the media tell us? Oh, there's going to be violence. It didn't happen. The moment Joe Biden gets into office, resident Joe Biden, we start having all these issues. Why? Can anyone answer that question? Why? You have people on TV saying, oh, they're killing innocent children. Okay, they're innocent adults being killed also. A life is a life. Don't get it twisted. What the Palestinians need to do is dump Hamas. Hamas cares nothing for the Palestinians. You give them an inch, we want a mile. You give them a mile, we want 2 miles. We want this, we want that. They don't care. And what they're given, they don't care about it. These people just want to keep up a big ruckus. If you're that small, why are you trying to poke at the bear that can come in and obliterate you? And then you want to say that it's not fair? Hamas needs to stop putting Muslim kids in harm's way. The Palestinian people need to denounce Hamas, and they need to tell Iran, go somewhere else. We're tired of this. This has got to stop, and we have got to start calling it out. And if it means calling out Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, who wants to say, well, my grandmother, she's in harm's way. Okay, Rashida, send a telegram to Hamas and tell them to get up and get out. Plain and simple. So I'm glad we have Heather on to talk to us about this conflict. I know that her mom the other day had written a piece that was really insightful as to what's happening right now. But we need to wake up. We need to wake the heck up and realize what's happening. We have three Trojan horses on the hill. They're creating trouble. And the amount of violence in the States with this is anti-Semitic. Let's get Heather on. Because Heather, what do you say?
Well, I think that the essence of it, fellas, is, you know, I think to get to the essence of it, what we saw happening on the streets of the world, whether Los Angeles, New York, Bal Harbour, Florida, London, you see that, and I don't really see how anyone with a brain could fail to see who the real aggressors are in the Middle East. I think that's an example. This is a microcosm of what Israel and Israelis have dealt with for now on about, I guess, 80 years close to now, since the day Israel was established and attacked the next day by five Arab armies. There are people in that region who are fanatical, resentful, bloodthirsty, hating of Jewish people, and can't stand the reality that Israel exists, a tiny Jewish state in the midst of many Islamist states. They hate its existence. They hate Jews. And that's what's driving this. And you see it when you see what happens in cities. I mean, who's attacking who? It's really, at essence, the bottom line. And unfortunately, Israelis are in a position, as they have been decade after decade. You know, it started with conventional warfare, again, even before Israel was formally established as a modern state. But upon establishment in 1948, five Arab armies attacked, were defeated. They attacked again in 1967, again in 1973, when conventional war was unwinnable for them, they began a long campaign of terrorism using the Palestinians as pawns. The inflamed Palestinians, who are people that have had offers again and again since Israel was established. It was divided in two by the United Nations. This had been a British controlled territory. The Palestinians, with the instigation of the other Arab states, refused the partition, chose to attack. Again, they've been offered statehood numerous times and rejected it, including in 2000 at Camp David. Arafat famously rejected a Palestinian state. And so I don't really see how, to anyone with a brain, it isn't obvious that these people don't want peace. I don't even know how many of them really want a state. I mean, there may be some who do, but I think the leadership clearly benefits from this constant war. It's a corrupt leadership that uses its own civilians as shields, and worse.
Well, just going back to what you said about Arafat, I mean, he was a constant player for years on the world stage, saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do that.
With $1 billion, died with $1 billion.
$1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, never once did he, I don't even think he was serious about peace.
No.
He wanted to keep the thing going.
Jerusalem, supposedly all the Clinton years, meeting after high-level diplomatic summit meeting, schmying around with Yasser Arafat for all those years. Ultimately, Ross wrote an 800-page book, the conclusion of which was that Yasser Arafat didn't really want peace, which I always thought was an example of how completely dense and refusing to see common sense this liberal diplomatic sort of obsession with diplomacy in the Middle East is. The plain fact is that the fanatical enemies of Israel do not want peace. There are many, many radical forces in that region. It's like a hydra with 1,000 heads. Israel, the Israeli government, has survived by its wits and its might for all these decades. And essentially, it's miraculous. It's miraculous that they have survived, because there are so many enemies in that region, and what unites them is a hatred. But again, Israelis have had to be smart and crafty and resilient, and they have. And all of these, you know, perhaps well-intentioned but naive efforts to force Israel to make concessions to terrorists have failed, as of course they were destined to fail and will continue to. And as far as I can see, the only thing Israel can do is be strong, be defensive, as they always are. The IDF stands for Israel Defense Forces. It's the only army ever in the world today, at least, that has the word defense in its name, because the army was founded on the premise that Israel will only ever fight a defensive war. And that has always been the case. Israel's not an expansionist country. If anything, the opposite. The Israeli government has numerous times carved the country up and given back land captured in defensive wars. It doesn't want to acquire land. It doesn't want to manage the Palestinians. It doesn't want to deal with these people. Frankly, who would? But the reality is they keep attacking, and the Israeli government has to respond. And so actually part of what's going on now, you'll recall that some years ago, there was a withdrawal from Gaza. You know, Israel had captured the territory in one of the defensive wars and was managing it because they didn't want to be attacked from Gaza. And all the international community was complaining about the occupation. So Ariel Sharon, at that time prime minister, exercised a lot of tremendous discipline and effort to uproot the Israeli settlers who were in that area, carried them out of their homes, you know, despite their resistance, pulled out of that territory. There is no more occupation, quote unquote. And you see now what Israel was rewarded with for that. Now, Gaza uses the area as a launching pad for war. And I remember at the time when people expressed concern about the withdrawal, one of the counterarguments was, well, you know, once Israel gets out of the territory, once these people are completely self-governed and not, you know, can't complain about any Israeli presence on what they consider to be their land, you know, then if they attack, they're a sovereign territory and they're in charge of themselves and Israel can't be faulted for fighting back. Well, guess what? Israel, at great expense and pain, withdrew and uprooted its own citizens to give this territory back to these people. And all they do is wage war from it. And when Israel fights back, they're condemned by the whole world. So they really can't win as far as the international community goes.
I think it's interesting, and we should note something that you just said, is that a lot of the territory that Israel has control of is because of the war that they were in, and they took control of the territories to protect themselves. Yes. So it's not as if, though, like you said, Israel is trying to, you know, occupy or expand itself. No. It's like, okay, we have control of this, the Gaza Strip and all the other places, so that we can protect ourselves.
Right. The Arabs keep attacking and starting these wars that they can't win. They keep, forgive me for being blunt, but they attack, they get their you-know-whats kicked, they lose more land, and then they cry about it and turn it into, we're refugees, da-da-da-da. And they become Israel's problem because the other Arab states won't take them in. So and it's a very convenient thing for the, you know, the Arab enemies of Israel. And let me just be clear that not all of the Arabs and Arab states are enemies. There has been progress. There are some wonderful individuals, you know, Arab people in the Middle East. There are, you know, there's a peace treaty now of sorts, you know, with Egypt for a while, but now also with Jordan. Now we have, you know, with the UAE and Bahrain and with Sudan, actually. Thanks to President Trump. I mean, there have been some advances. The Arab world is not monolithic, but some actors in the region insist on being intransigent and insist on the old ways and the backward mentality. And, you know, a friend of mine asked me recently, why would they do this? Why do they keep doing this? And I said, I don't know why. I mean, it makes no sense. Why did bin Laden attack the U.S. on 9/11? I mean, from a purely logical standpoint, there's really no good reason. I mean, it's fanaticism. It's hatred. And there are probably elements that are corrupt, that are, you know, more like the mob, that benefit from the status quo and keeping things the way they are, keeping the Palestinian people very much subjugated and inflamed. And so it's a real pickle.
A real pickle, but I've got to go back over this again, because I want to make certain that our listeners understand what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, Israel is not trying to expand itself and the territories that it has in order to protect its borders, because Hamas, the terrorists, will use those areas as launching pads. So when you see, or they say, oh, they're taking our land, they're taking our houses, they're kicking us out, it's because if they don't, they can't protect themselves, because Hamas will come in and use those same areas that people are living in as launching pads. And something else that's worth noting that you said is that when Sharon, what was his name?
Ariel Sharon.
Prime Minister had went in and said, okay, the Israelis that are living here, we're going to uproot you and give this land back to the Palestinians.
Yes.
Okay, and in doing so, they were jeopardizing their safety. But
well, you know, Rob, the thing is, that was, I mean, the argument at the time, and I'm looking it up here, I believe the Gaza withdrawal, if I'm not mistaken, was, let me see the year, I think it was... I want to say 2004, but
even in doing so, by giving that land up,
yes, they basically
jeopardizing the living safety. There.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they were, to be honest, I think it may have actually, at the moment anyway, helped the safety of those, that small number of Jewish settlers who were there, because they were, you know, they were surrounded by hostile Arabs. I mean, they were kind of like, you know, I guess the left would view them as usurpers, and, you know, others might view them as brave pioneers. They were trying to, you know, they believed that that's part of biblical Israel, and they were there to settle the land, and they certainly weren't there to hurt anybody, you know, or pick any violent fire. I mean, they were just living basically on a little bit of land, but that was viewed by some of the Arabs as a provocation, you know, because we have this whole idea that it's not like living on a certain piece of land is a provocation, which I think is questionable to begin with. It's kind of like, since when is that ever viewed as justification for murder? I mean, except in this crazy situation. But anyway, they were a small number of people, and they were determined to stay, but Ariel Sharon made the decision that this was not tenable, that it was better to uproot them. Yes. And at the time, it caused great division in Israeli society, because a lot of the, you know, people on the more conservative end of the spectrum were furious. They said, you know, these are our fellow Jews. How can you force them out of their homes, you know, in what was biblical Israel, to, you know, say that they're not hurting anybody, and why can't Jews live on this little bit of land? But he decided, you know, no, they have to leave. You know, the government will compensate them. And if you guys remember, at the time, it was a very traumatic thing for Israel, because the IDF, basically the people who were living there, they were hardcore settlers, you know, what the media would call right-wing settlers. And they, you know, they were peaceful, but they were saying, we won't go. And the IDF was called in to physically remove them. But, you know, you could tell from the pictures that the IDF soldiers were handling them as if they were, you know, little precious babies. I mean, they were carrying them out, you know, to make sure that the hair on their head wasn't harmed. They were not being rough with them, but they had to physically, you know, take them and carry them and remove them, you know. And there was the fear that it would be Jew against Jew, that it would be, you know, the army would, you know, would have gotten rough if they had to, because there was no alternative. But thankfully, as I recall, I think it was, you know, it was traumatic, but it was basically peaceful, because it didn't come to violence between the settlers and the IDF. But they, you know, they did passive resistance. They had to be dragged out of their homes. And it was, you know, it was very tense. And a lot of people opposed it. Most of the Israeli public, you know, went with it and supported it because they felt that it was, you know, because again, it gets back to this idea, Israel's not an expansionist country, you know. Israel doesn't want, I mean, there are religious people in Israel who believe that these areas are Judea and Samaria, that Gaza and the West Bank are Judea and Samaria, that they are part of biblical Israel. But, you know, most Israelis are pragmatists and, you know, they'd like it, sure, but they're like, listen, if the price of peace is Judea and Samaria, take it. You know, we'll get these people off the land. We'll give it, you know, give it back to the Arabs if they want it so much. Just give us peace. I mean, that's the overwhelming, you know, that's the majority opinion. So that's what happened in the Gaza withdrawal. And you see, it did not give them peace.
And that's what I was about to say. The Gaza withdrawal, and did it bring peace? No. Again, what you just explained is all too important. And I would encourage people who don't understand the history or understand what's going on. What you just said is huge, that you have a segment within the Jewish population that are saying, okay, if it's going to give us peace, take the land. Take
the majority, yes.
A majority. They're saying to take it. But in doing so, you still have this group, this element that keeps pushing back that wants more. And you have these people in the United States that are completely unaware of the history that are saying, oh no, Israel, they're taking, they're taking, they're taking. But here in this instance, like you said, Ariel Sharon said, okay, here, but still, what do we have today? Mm-hmm. There's Hamas out of the blue decided, okay, we're going to attack Israel. And like you said, they can't win a conventional war. Yeah. They're not going to win. So it's for naught. Why are they doing this? Why do they consistently do this? Mm-hmm. Knowing that, okay, if you engage in this, they're going to take more from you to protect themselves. And Israel has every right to protect itself. And I'm ashamed that President Biden and his VP are going on Twitter to say that Israel has a right to protect itself. What is Twitter? Twitter isn't like a record of paper. Twitter is just a social media box that can be manipulated and shut out at any given point in time. Now imagine had President Trump done that. Oh my God, he's running policy on Twitter. But yet and still, President Biden can go in and he can do it. And people, oh, well, he did say that Israel has a right. No, that's not acceptable. I want him to get on TV and I want him to openly say that Israel has a right to protect itself. And we, the United States, will support them because they are our allies and vice versa. Why hasn't he done it? Why hasn't the media called him out on it? It's disgraceful what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and then to see, not only that, to see the Jewish community being attacked in New York and other cities, it's disgraceful. And Biden hasn't come out and said anything, but yet still they wanted President Trump to come out every time there was a ruckus. Oh, you need to come out and you need to denounce it. You need to denounce this, denounce that. Why hasn't Biden denounced the violence on the Israelis here in America, the Jews here in America, and in Israel?
That's a good point, Robin. I mean, how many times did we hear President Trump won't denounce white supremacy? It was so ridiculous. He kept denouncing it. He kept saying constantly, there is no place for white supremacy. There is no place for the KKK and for all these people. They're bad actors. They're rough types. We don't want them. I mean, he said it, he denounced it over and over, and the media would say, well, he didn't denounce it. But yes, it's like, you're right. It's just patently absurd. I mean, the other thing I should mention, Rob, that I didn't, is in terms of why are they doing this? Hamas is the proxy of Iran. So really what's going on in addition to the usual is this is a proxy war. This is a message to the United States, to President Biden, I believe, from the Iranian regime, saying we're free to throw our weight around now. We'll, you know, be the power in the Middle East.
Which isn't good at all. And I've said that before as well. Is Iran is the problem. And Biden wants to cozy up with Iran, with John Kerry, whom we all know was working behind the scenes when Trump was president. feeding Iran all manner of, if you do this, just wait, we're going to have him out of there. We're going to have him out. Then we'll re-engage you. We'll give you all this money.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Crazy. I don't know what to say about that.
It's really sad that Israel was getting attacked with rockets that they say could have been funded by us with this Obama deal when he gave all this money to Iran. Mm-hmm. And then they said that's how Hamas paid for a lot of these rockets that were raining down on Israel. You guys are tuned in to After Dark with Rob and Andrew, available on America Out Loud via iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the America Out Loud app to keep track of all of the great shows. We will be back with more from journalist Heather Robinson.
As we celebrate our five-year anniversary, America Out Loud has expanded its mission through a newly designed website with a host of new contributors, all carrying a vibrant message of hope and survival for this country we love. AmericaOutLoud.com. Together, we'll secure the future for generations to come.
Each of us is born with 30 trillion cells that make us. These cells determine how we feel, perform, sleep, focus, and how long we live. And to live our best life, all we have to do is feed our cells. But most food and supplements don't reach our cells, keeping us from reaching our full potential. Make every cell count with Healthy Cell. Founded with a mission to empower people to take control of their own health at the most fundamental level, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, world-renowned cell researcher and medical doctor, created supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. And that's HealthyCell.com. HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
And we're back with our guest journalist, Heather Robinson. And before we went to break, we were talking about the conflict that exists between Hamas and Israel. And we, at certain points of the conversation, we kept pointing out that we weren't indicting all Palestinians or Muslims, because they're good and bad on both sides. There are some hard-nosed Israelis that feel that, hey, we shouldn't concede anything. We should just move fast forward to end this. And there are some Palestinians that are saying, we need to take a step back. Hamas is not helping us. We have been in this conflict for years, centuries, or decades, and we still haven't gotten anywhere. And Heather, you were saying before we went to break, or you were saying during break, before we came back online, that you yourself have worked with Muslims. And mm-hmm. I don't want to say it in a way like they say, well, you know, all people aren't bad, but we're being truthful and authentic here, because mm-hmm. I think it's worth noting, coming from a Jewish woman who's saying, look, I can look at this and I can be objective, but I have worked with Muslims, and I'm not indicting them all and saying that they're all bad. Go ahead and tell your story, Heather.
Oh, sure, Rob. Well, I mean, I've had the honor to work through the years with Mithal Alalusi, who's a former Iraqi parliamentarian. His children were murdered by al-Qaeda during the Iraq War, and he's one of the true righteous people on earth. He's a friend of Israel. It's an amazing story what he's done. He was very tenacious and stayed in Iraq after this atrocity, and he got elected to parliament. He served three terms. He did a Herculean job trying to bring progress to that country. And so, you know, that's tangentially connected in that he was a champion of a modern Iraq. He believed and does believe that Iran has infiltrated Iraq, has been a bad actor in the region for many decades, has undermined any efforts toward democracy. And he focused a lot on Israel. He wanted to normalize relations between Iraq and Israel. And that's why his children were murdered, because the terrorists in the region are so threatened by anyone who's got a vision for a modern Middle East, for progress, for an end to these ancient and pointless hatreds. And so there are people, there are brave Arab Muslim leaders. Unfortunately, they don't have as much power as I believe they should. Maybe it's a function of the fact that radicals tend to be people who seize power and, you know, wield power brutally, tend to exercise disproportionate influence in the world, especially in that part of the world. It's a horrible neighborhood in that way, I guess. But I also was very fortunate to go to the West Bank some years ago. I went to Ramallah with a businessman, Daniel Lubetsky, who owns the Kind Company. I don't know if you're familiar with Kind bars, and you see them in a lot of stores, Whole Foods, etc. He's now quite successful. You know, this was, I guess, maybe a little over a decade ago when he was still building his empire. And his first company was based on this idea of joint venture between Israelis and Palestinians. And so I went with him and met some of the Palestinian businessmen who work with him, who were working with Israel. People who, they were doing it, you know, as pragmatists, I think, you know, partly for their own financial gain, you know, as capitalists. I mean, I guess they were comparatively among the more sort of pragmatic people in that area. And I guess if you're going to go to the territories, Ramallah is the most, I guess, considered the most moderate, comparatively speaking, place to be. But when I was there, I did meet some, you know, I met some people who seemed nice, and you know, they were made uncomfortable by some of the questions I was asking, which highlighted to me that this was not a free territory. You can't speak freely there. You can't ask certain questions. And incidentally, that's why the coverage is by definition slanted. Anything that you see coming out of the Palestinian territories, you know, a journalist can't operate there unless if you're writing something that Hamas or the Palestinian Authority doesn't approve and like. So basically, you can't report critically from the territories. And I know that for a fact, because I tried to do it. I mean, I tried to go there and ask questions, and I was told very quickly to stop it, or I would endanger myself and my whole party. So, but anyway, I mean, I did meet some people there who seemed like nice people, and who, I think one of them was a young man, you know, who seemed, he just, you know, he was a cool guy, and he was talking to me about his efforts to entertain children and open discussions there with school kids about how not Jews aren't all bad. And he seemed like a gay guy. I mean, he seemed very, I'm a New Yorker, so I say that with love. He seemed like just a cool, creative young guy, Palestinian guy. And he and I were hitting it off, and we were told, you know, knock it off. Don't continue that line of discussion, or, you know, you're going to be in trouble. So anyway, my point, I guess, here is double. One is that, yes, there are cool, nice people in the Palestinian territories. And B, you know, you can't, it's not a free, they're not free. They're not free to speak what they want. I mean, they can't just, they could never have a show like yours, Rob, let's put it that way. You know, they couldn't speak critically of the leadership. So, you know, you really get a sense that the tragedy is compounded in that a lot of these people, you know, would perhaps under different circumstances, you know, be interested in coexistence with Jews. And, you know, they're not, those aren't the people in power in these places.
What exactly is a problem with Iran? Iran, formerly known as Persia. I heard back in the day it was like a beautiful place. But then the mullahs and the shahs and all the other individuals came in with their repressive religion and thoughts. And that's it. That for the most part, the people in Iran, they love Western culture.
Yes.
But it's the mullahs and all these other individuals. They're not Muslims, are they?
I believe so. They're Shia Muslims in Iran. Okay. That's a whole big divide, the Shia and Sunni divide. I'm not an expert on Iran, the history of Iran. I know that there is, yes, 1979, of course, there was
a revolution.
Khomeinist revolution. They took over. And it started off as kind of a, I guess like many revolutions, right? They sometimes start off as seeming idealistic, and some people thought it wouldn't be such a bad thing. But yes, it's a very extremist, true religious extremism, which, I know that's something that gets thrown around a lot, and liberals like to accuse, people around here of being extremist right-wingers, but they have no idea, this is a really, true fanaticism. These are people who, stone people to death for their sexuality, who, demand absolute conformity and, impose phenomenal cruelty and brutality on people who want to educate girls. I mean, they're truly repressive fanatics. And they seized control in 1979. They ousted the Shah, who was a U.S. ally. And since then, there's just a radical Shia government, Muslim, extremist government in control in Iran, who's made no secret of intent to completely destroy and annihilate the entire country of Israel. That's their rallying cry. They've conducted numerous vicious terrorist operations around the world. I know since at least the 70s, one was the bombing of a synagogue in Buenos Aires, I think in 1983, they bombed, they've killed a lot of civilians around the world. A lot of, Mithal, my source in Iraq, believes they were responsible, Iran, for the great portion of the deaths and dismemberment of U.S. soldiers in Iraq, that Iran masterminded the IED campaign designed to, terrorize our soldiers and service members out of Iraq. As you recall, the way they were planting bombs, so that our soldiers would be, blown up when they least expected. That's a very much a terrorist type tactic, and that's the kind of thing that Iran's regime specializes in. They conduct these brutal surprise, attacks designed to sow terror and make Jews and Americans and, who top the people they hate, feel on the defensive, vulnerable, and scared. And that's what they've been exporting since at least 1979. That's their specialty. Now they want a nuclear weapon. So, that's very, why President Obama sent them suitcases full of money. Why Joe Biden is sending them money is a complete and total mystery to me. I have no insight except to say that it's extreme naivete on the part of our government. I think that Israel's government and people is much more realistic about who these people are. They've been dealing with them for decades more directly than we have. They're in the same neighborhood. They know that they're, the other thing too is that Iran and Iraq fought a vicious war for, I guess, like a decade. I know the deaths were, I believe, in the millions. And this was, Saddam Hussein against the mullahs of Iran. And the jury's sort of out on who was more brutal. They were at each other's throats for all that time. Again, that's, I think some of that is the Sunni Shia, kind of battle. And I'm not an expert in it, but I do know that, many people, including in Israel, Israel will never go against America. But I know at the time of the Iraq war, there were Israeli generals, my sources have told me, that who expressed, a disagreement with the policy, felt that even though Saddam Hussein was phenomenally brutal and a bad, bad tyrant, that he was, he and Iran were beating up on each other. And when he was removed, Iran's, the long arm of Iran was strengthened. And
a vacuum was created, right. Oh, yes. I've heard that before also.
Yes, and now we have a double whammy because of the Iraq war, we got rid of Saddam, which was in many ways a good thing, but it strengthened Iran. And then we had the liberals, the Democrats, come in and give Iran all kinds of money and appease them. So you see, it's like a 1-2. It's actually a phenomenally terrible combination because we took away Iran's, you know, biggest enemy. And now, you know, I mean, okay, I mean, that might have been, you know, a mixed bag because this horrible dictator Saddam was gone, who also wanted nukes. But now, then, instead of containing Iran, the Democrats came in and started appeasing Iran, which just, you know, okay, we removed their enemy, we're giving them all kinds of money, they're stronger than ever, and they want to take over the Middle East and take over the world. And now I think they're also working with, you know, possibly with Russia and China. I mean, it's you know, it's a very bad axis. And I hate to say it, but I, you know, from my humble perspective, it sounds like, you know, the combination, it's sort of like we're naive about, we perhaps miscalculated and, you know, didn't anticipate the negative consequence of removing Saddam. And then the Democrats compounded the error by giving a lot of money to Iran. So the bottom line is Iran is strengthened now. They're flexing their muscles, and, you know, that's what this is, what, you know, why Hamas is tormenting Israel. And the larger threat is that Iran is always moving toward nuclear capability, which would be a complete and unmitigated disaster. It would be a second Holocaust, and it can't be allowed to happen. So whatever Israel has to do, they will do to prevent that from happening.
And rightfully so. And Joe Biden is weak Biden. He can't do anything. And they're certainly not afraid of him.
Yeah, a lot of people thought President Trump did a great job in his 4 years doing in his foreign policy, other than a couple incidents with Syria and him taking out some bad terrorists. The Middle East seemed to be more peaceful than it had been in several decades.
Yes.
We've seen Israel signing several peace treaties with other countries.
Yep.
How big of a setback is this latest incident with the Palestinians and Israel and their peace treaties with these other Middle Eastern countries? Do you think that it will affect that?
Gosh, I'm not sure, Andrew, but I agree with you. I think Trump did a phenomenal job in the Middle East. You know, I mean, how anyone could argue with that, I don't see. Things were really starting to move. Three peace treaties. Any other president would have gotten a Nobel Peace Prize. And I think I think that the perception of Trump as tough and a strong man and kind of a crazy man was good when it came to the Middle East, because I think these people were scared of Trump. And, you know, I think that in terms of whether these treaties will hold and all that, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think there's other factors too that have to do with economics, which isn't really my area so much. Hopefully there's enough benefit. I mean, Israel is a power, not just militarily, but scientifically, environmentally. They have wonderful treaties and cooperative projects with Jordan when it comes to water. They have a lot of scientific partnerships. And I don't know all the details of what these countries, you know, what the UAE and Bahrain and Sudan got in exchange for the peace treaties, but hopefully whatever it is, you know, will be enough to, you know, to keep them, to honor them. But also I think these countries are scared of Iran because, again, Iran's been very strengthened in the past, you know, couple decades. And I think that the Saudis as well, that's also, the Saudis are Sunni Muslims. We know that they're not all good. I mean, they've exported a lot of terrorism themselves, including many of the 9/11 hijackers and, you know, bin Laden himself. So I'm not trying to romanticize all of them, but I think some of them, my understanding is that, you know, there are a lot of very wealthy people in Saudi Arabia, some of whom want to enjoy their wealth and are more interested in that than in waging eternal war. And yeah, I think they fear Iran. I think that some of them are less fanatics and more rich people who want to keep having a good time. And, you know, they're scared that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, it's going to be like curtains, not just for Israel, but for Saudi Arabia and all these other countries, which it certainly would. So, you know, that's all part of the picture too, you know, in terms of, you know, what they're going to do and how they're going to, and the fact that they're all scared of the Iranians is kind of part of what's keeping things, you know, keeping some of these treaties in check, in place, I think. So it's very complicated in that way. But I do agree that Trump did a great job.
I think he did a fantastic job, and we should all be afraid of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. As we said earlier on, why Obama agreed to give them a pallet full of money, cash, knowing what they were going to do with it. And when Trump came in and said, okay, we're going to end this, and you had many on the left, like John Kerry, coming out speaking against it. What are you guys going to profit? We only know half of it. And that's the reason why Trump came in saying, let's drain the swamp. And then when John Kerry was called before Congress to testify, and they asked him the question, you know, did you have a meeting with any of the Iranians on what was taking place in the United States? And he says, well, and they gave him a particular time. They said in 2019 or 2017. He goes, well, I don't remember 2019, but I do seem to remember speaking with them in 2018. It's like, so 2018 is 2 years earlier, and you don't remember the most recent. Really? John, are you lying? The fact that he went there, and I'm going to say it, I think he lied. He flat out lied.
Strange. The whole thing is so weird.
Right. There are no consequences. You know, you haul these guys up, there are no consequences. Whereas an Iranian said, John Kerry told us X, Y, and Z. And Kerry goes, oh, I don't know. It's horrible. And not to mention our Secretary of State, Blinken, when all this was going on, never once went over to speak to any of the delegates, the Israelis. And then the calls would bite and bite and say, oh, when I'm speaking to Benjamin Netanyahu every day, I seriously doubt that. It was more than likely Vice President Kamala Harris. So the whole thing just smells that the United States is not protecting its ally at a moment that they need to protect the ally. And why? Because we have three knuckleheads on the Hill that are against it. And even Bernie Sanders, he's against it.
Oh,
and it's sad, you know, to see that our country has fallen so far, and for the media not to call this out. These guys have got to lose in 2022 and 2024, because that is the only way the truth will come out. And when they lose, they need to lose bigly, as they say. And we need to root out all of those people that are entrenched on the Hill, those career politicians that have jobs that they can't leave. You can't fire them. We need to be able to fire them all, because I think Trump made it possible to fire these individuals. Because when you leave them there and a new administration comes in, an administration that they don't agree with, they will work in opposition. And we saw this with President Trump. I was amazed that Jared Kushner was able to achieve so much. Mm-hmm. And what did the media do? They downplayed it. They downplayed all that he had achieved and said, oh, it's no big deal. He's getting peace with this country. Oh, it's no big deal. With Sudan, oh, it's no big deal. That is a big deal. But they downplayed it because Obama couldn't do it. He couldn't do it because he could have cared less. And now look at what's happening.
I know. It was crazy. I mean, I couldn't get over how much was accomplished. And my only thought with Obama, just as a side note, I don't know if this is true, but the only thing I could figure with him, and I don't really know if it's true of the others, I didn't know that about Kerry's daughter. I always thought that Obama was naive, that he, you know, had this kumbaya sort of attitude. He did help Israel build the Iron Dome, which was something very positive that Obama did. I don't think he hated Israel or something, but I think that he thought that if we just are nice to the enemies and give them whatever, I guess, money, everybody will play nice in the sandbox kind of thing. And, you know, that there would be this kind of parity between the United States and others. We know, you know, President Obama, I think, was kind of a one world globalist and was uncomfortable with the idea of American power. And so for him, I don't think he grasped how vicious this Iranian regime really is. I don't think he felt it in his bones in the same way that people do who, you know, have encountered it directly or who are Jewish maybe. Yeah, I mean, it was like, for us, it's like, you know, giving money to the KKK. I mean, it's like, why would you ever in a million years, you know? Well, I don't know what, I don't know what Biden's thinking. I don't, you know, I guess it's just this more of this appeasement kind of mindset, which, yeah, when it comes to really real brutal fanatics, that doesn't work. So Israel's just got to be strong, just got to, you know, survive by its wits and do what it has to do.
Well, I don't think Biden is thinking. I think he's just there in the limelight, you know, listening to whomever. I think, if anything, Obama is probably instructing him or his staff as to what should take place. But I'm terribly disappointed that he has not come out forcefully and say that we support Israel. So I can only imagine what Benjamin Netanyahu is thinking, that this is our ally. And why isn't he coming out? We all know that Benjamin and Obama did not have a great working relationship. He felt that Obama, as you said, was naive, an elitist. And he didn't do anything, in my opinion, to try and curtail any of the violence that would have taken place. He didn't try to work. I mean, you would think he would have tried to work with both sides and say, hey, this is what we need to do, and encourage the Palestinians to dump Hamas. Hamas, like you said, they're funded by Iran. And we gave Iran money.
Yeah.
So once this is squelched, I mean, there is only a matter of time before something else takes place. And you would think people would look at this and say, wait a minute, Hamas, you launched the first, you know, rockets or whatnot. So you're killing our people. You got to stop. Why are you doing this?
Yeah, that's true too, Rob. I don't know if that's what you meant, but a lot of the Hamas rockets, I think like about a third of them landed on the Palestinians themselves.
Yeah, so it's like, so why?
Some of these poor children who died, you know, were killed by Hamas. And I mean, you know, it's only Israel that gets blamed. And, you know, Israel's in this position of responding, you know, and it is very sad. But you know, the world needs to be clear that ultimately the responsibility rests on Hamas. It's like, why would you, if you can't or won't protect your civilians, and they make absolutely zero less an attempt to do so, because I believe that, you know, racking up the civilian death toll is actually what they want. It's part of their strategy.
Yep, it is. To get sympathy, to rack up the death toll, they'll say, oh my God, look at all the people that you're killing, but you're responsible. You're directly responsible for the deaths of the children.
You're putting your weapons, you know, it's like, I've seen aerial photos of Gaza. And yes, it's densely populated, but there are fields, there are open spaces, there are other places they could put these weapons. They will not do it because this is how they fight, you know? They're punks, you know, they use their civilians as cannon fodder. And I think it's very sad. It makes me sad. And I care, you know, whenever I hear about a child dying, I've been very upset this past week, the whole week, you know, about the little Israeli boy who died and all these Palestinian children, very sad. But I cannot, you know, I don't want to lose the clarity. I don't want to start getting fuzzy headed about the reality that, you know, this is what Hamas does. They set up a situation. It would be like if, God forbid, somebody firebombed your house and threatened your children, and then, you know, surrounded himself with his own children while he kept firebombing your house. You know, it's like the police are going to have to deal with the situation. You can't just let yourself be killed because this person is employing completely shameless tactics. You know, it's just, you know, it's a very clear setup and manipulation, you know, and, you know, it's very sad, and the world should know what's going on about it, though, and not, you know, and call out Hamas. And what, you know, I tell you what, when I hear these people, you know, condemning Israel, you know, I just want to say to them, even if you don't think Israel should fight back, you know, at the very least, if this is really about the children, for you, wouldn't you also condemn Hamas? Wouldn't you say, you know what?
You would think they would.
But they don't. So I question whether they even care about these children that much.
It's all political. It's all political. Because as you said earlier, they're not going to win this. And if Israel were to come down with all its might, they could just end this like a couple of bombs or whatnot, rockets.
Well, that's true too. That's true.
And it's over. But they're saying, hey, they're measured.
Sure.
We're not going to do that. We're going to target key areas. And then when they blew up the building, the AP building that housed Hamas.
Yeah.
And then for the AP to say, oh, we didn't know about it. I don't buy that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, are you serious?
Yeah.
I don't buy it.
I mean, I knew within 5 minutes of being in the Palestinian territories that there was that I was being controlled and censored, and I could not stay there another minute without towing the line. Yeah. It's not, you can't even ask questions that offend anybody there without being threatened. So those companies can't operate in that. That's a dirty secret, in journalism, but from the Middle East, that just isn't spoken, which is that all the media companies that are operating there, especially if they have like a permanent office there. I don't know if Fox News has like a full-time office. They do report from the West Bank and Gaza sometimes, but if you're operating there and you're comfortably, in an office and this and that, I mean, you're not going to be allowed to stay there for long, if you're reporting unfavorably about Hamas, or if you have critical things to say about what they're doing. So, yeah, I mean, these media companies, you can condemn them for it or not. You can say, well, they have to, they want to cover it. They want to be in business. So they, participate in, they tailor the news, they tweak it to satisfy, Hamas. You can agree with their right to do that or not, but the reality is that it's all, the media coverage from that territory is basically going to be propaganda that's acceptable to Hamas, or the media company's going to get kicked out.
Absolutely. And then members of our political class, like Bernie Sanders, Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, they're just completely miseducated, or they're willingly ignorant on what's going on and just shouting tons of misinformation that is borderline anti-Semitic. We remember Ilhan Omar, she said all about the Benjamins, which is definitely borderline, it is anti-Semitic if you ask me, but we will see how this plays out with these members in our Congress who seem to be placating towards Joe Biden. Such a great show tonight with journalist Heather Robinson. We thank her for joining us, and thank you for all for joining us tonight on After Dark with Robin Andrew. Check us out on all the other shows over at AmericaOutloud.com. who just celebrated its 5th anniversary. You can also find America Out Loud on iHeartRadio, Spotify, or Stitcher. We will see you guys next time, and remember to stand for something or you will fall for nothing.